Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 16th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, why the naked mole rat is insensitive to acid, how to identify relationships in large data sets, and a new shot at a tuberculosis vaccine, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The naked mole rat has a number of outlandish features, including an insensitivity to acid. That insensitivity lets them tolerate the high levels of carbon dioxide found in their underground homes, levels that would be noxious to most other animals. Despite their hardiness in the face of acid, mole rats have the same pain receptors as mice and humans. But as Ewan St. John Smith and colleagues report this week in Science, the mole rat also has a modification in a sodium channel found on their pain receptor cells. When protons from an acid encounter the channel, its opening is inhibited, and action potentials, which depend on an influx of ions through these channels, are blocked. The result? No pain signal is transmitted to the nervous system. St. John Smith spoke with me about how this blockage adds complexity to the story of pain perception.
So we've been working with the African naked mole rat for about 5 or 6 years, and we published a few years ago a very unusual finding, which is that when you inject acidic saline solution into the pore of this animal, that it displays no nocive behavior. So whereas a mouse would lick its paw, the naked mole rat doesn't do anything. And similarly, if you put acidic solutions into the hands of humans through infusion, they normally find it as a sort of burning pain sensation that slowly goes away over time. So here we had the naked mole rat, which displayed no nocive behavior in response to an acidic solution that many other animals throughout the animal kingdom find noxious, so even a leech, but they have nociceptive neurons that respond to acid. And what we also showed at that point was that in an isolated skin nerve preparation, the nerves from these animals did not respond to acid. If you take the saphenous nerve, which innervates the hind paw of a mouse or a naked mole rat, if you pour acid onto the nerve in the mouse, about 20% of the neurons will respond with action potentials. And in the naked mole rat, this doesn't occur. So you have an animal which had no behavioral response to acid, and also the nerves themselves did not respond, whereas it's known that those from mice do and those from humans do. So we really have this conundrum of what's the difference between the nervous system of a naked mole rat and the nervous system of a mouse or also a human that could explain this difference. With this study, we've shown that in the acid pathway, as it were, you have these ion channels which you can activate through depolarization, but that they're not the only thing that's important. And that really this 1.7 ion channel is clearly in a key place in the pain pathway to be blocked.
So let's get down into some of the details. Can you explain how pain receptors work to alert the body to painful things like acids?
So it's obviously very important that every organism has an ability to detect and react to its environment. And this is the reason why in mammals, for instance, we have a specific set of sensory neurons that are only activated by noxious stimuli. So, for example, there are some neurons that respond to touch, and the force that activates these touch receptors is not enough to activate a nociceptor, whereas these nociceptors, the sensory neurons that only respond to noxious stimuli, require a much greater stimulus. And so normally what happens is in the end terminals of these sensory neurons, they have an array of different ion channels and receptors that can respond to different stimuli. So there are different ion channels that have been cloned from mammalian neurons which can respond to acid. And in general, it's an ion channel or receptor that's activated by a stimulus. And this leads to depolarization of a neuron. And when this depolarization is great enough, this will lead to the activation of voltage-gated sodium channels, certainly mammalian neurons, and you can get an action potential in a mammalian neuron. This depolarization event after activation of an ion channel, if it's great enough, you activate a voltage-gated sodium channel, this leads to an action potential, and then this action potential signal is carried into the spinal cord. This will then synapse onto one or more neurons, and the nociceptive information will be taken to the brain, as it were. And this is where it's important to distinguish between pain and nociception, because nociception is just the activation of a nociceptor, and this can lead to a nociceptive reflex. So, for instance, a leech will move away from a noxious substance, whereas pain is much more the emotional component. And obviously, in organisms which don't have a highly developed brain or a highly developed central ganglion, it can be argued that, well, they can't really have pain because they don't have this emotional component. It's just the nociception, it's the ability to detect something that could damage the body and be able to react to this.
I understand that naked mole rats are kind of unique in the animal kingdom. How do they end up exposed to high levels of acid?
Okay, so the naked morris is really kind of unique mammal. I think unique is a word you have to be very careful about using, but these are mammals which are cold-blooded, which is, as far as I'm aware, unique. And on top of that, they live in a very unusual environment. So they live in Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia underground. So they live in a tunnel system in an environment where the temperature doesn't alter by more than 2 or 3 degrees from season to season and from night to day. It could be argued there's been no selection pressure there for them to maintain warm-bloodedness, and it's been more efficient for them to become cold-blooded. And similarly, this environment has offered certain opportunities, and one of these is the development of eusociality, which means it's similar to a bee and an ant. These animals live with a queen. So there's one animal that's a breeding female, and she'll normally breed with 2 or 3 males. And like a bee or an ant colony, the queen just breeds and breeds and breeds, and the colony stays as one. So an average colony will be up to about 100 animals, but they have been seen in the wild to be as large as 300 animals. So you've got this large amount of animals which are living underground in very narrow tunnels, and they have a nest area. And if you have all these animals living together and breathing together, that means that the carbon dioxide level is going to be much greater than in the ambient outside environment. And indeed, certainly in laboratories, it's been measured in the nest environments that the CO2 concentration get up to about 5%. And obviously underground, which hasn't, as far as I'm aware, been really measured yet, is likely to be much higher than 5%. Carbon dioxide, of course, when it reaches a fluid environment, will be converted into carbonic acid. And an acid will activate a sensory neuron, and this will evoke a nociception response, or is painful to humans. If you take a spray of carbon dioxide and spray it on the inside of your nose or onto the wet surface of the eye, this is a burning sensation. So naked morat, due to living in these large communities in an environment with very little fresh air, as it were, is exposed to high levels of CO2. This can be converted into acid, and this means that the animal would either have to find a way of managing this acid load, so either perhaps they have a very different buffering system going on, or for instance with what we've described in the nociceptive system, it could well be that they are exposed to a higher level of acid, but the sodium channel with these 2 amino acid variants is switched off so that the acid doesn't evoke a constant nociceptive reaction in the animal. So it's really the animal has adapted to its environment with a high CO2 load, which in turn would evoke acidosis, and it's evolved not to react to this acidosis.
So you say that, you know, they're swimming around in this acid, and you know that any other organism that you could think of, mouse or leech, would not tolerate it at all.
I think that's quite likely. I mean, there are certainly studies that have been published where very low CO2 concentrations evoke fear and avoidance in mice.
Given that these naked mole rats are, as you say, unique in the true sense, what can we actually generalize from this study?
I think there are 2 important things that have come out of this study. And one is sort of not so much on the naked morat work from this project, but more on the mouse work. Because previously the dogma was, well, okay, we've identified ion channels that you can activate with acid, and these are relatively specifically expressed in sensory neurons that are involved in this pain pathway. So the idea is, for instance, if you're in the kitchen, you cut your finger, that hurts, then half an hour later you squirt some lemon juice in and it stings. Why does it sting? Oh, well, that's because acid activates these ion channels in the sensory neurons, and that gives pain. Well, what we've sort of shown with the mouse work is that, well, the majority of neurons respond to acid. But when you then switch to the current clamp mode to measure the ability of an acidic stimulus to generate an action potential, which of course is what's going to be important in vivo, then very few neurons responded. So in the mouse, we found it was about 6.5%. And it was only when we then took the next step and started looking at these voltage-gated sodium channels and saw how the IC50 for the inhibition of these ion channels is about pH 6, you realize, well, okay, it's not going to be a simple matter of activating these ion channels and this causes pain. There's also this balance between the depolarizing input and the inhibition of these voltage-gated sodium channels. So I think we've kind of found out a bit more about how acid is able to activate the neurons. And presumably those neurons where we do see an action potential, there must be a difference either between the types of voltage-gating sodium channel subunit that are expressed in this neuron or the amount of ion channels present that respond to acid. And I think this next step to the model, it's too easy to think, okay, we pour acid on, you activate an ion channel, you get pain. There's more to it than that. You've got these ion channels responsible for then the action potential that are also inhibited by acid. So it's a more complex system as originally thought. And I think what the mole rat work shows us, where it shows that the 1.7 sodium channel is the difference between the mouse and the naked mole rat, shows that this ion channel is really fundamental for a fully functioning nociceptive system, which links in with the human work, where you can see that the humans with have a null mutation in this ion channel have normal nociceptors, but they can't be activated, and also those which have a hyperactive form of this ion channel, they have pain syndromes. They have a hyperactive, sensitive system. And so I think the Naked Wire work emphasizes, again, the real importance of this 1.7 ion channel, and that from a therapeutic point of view, if it's possible to develop a drug which specifically can inhibit this sodium channel subunit as opposed to a global blocker such as local anesthetics, then you may be able to switch off those nerves that are important for sensing noxious stimuli and generating pain without having the side effects of many of the drugs that are out there. I mean, taking a local anesthetic is great for not feeling pain, but you don't feel very much at all, and it then obviously has an effect on your ability to carry out everyday tasks and have a normal life. Mm-hmm. Similarly, you can take morphine. It works for a lot of people, but not all people, but it works for a lot of people as a great painkiller, but at the same time, there's a lot of side effects to it.
Ewan Sinjin Smith, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Ewan Sinjin Smith and colleagues report on pain perception in naked mole rats in this week's Science.
From genomics to physics to sports records, large and cumbersome data sets are becoming increasingly common. But with potentially hundreds of variables or more, extracting meaningful relationships from these data is no easy task. This week, David and Yakir Reshef and colleagues describe a powerful new statistical method called the maximal information coefficient, or MIC, that identifies the complex relationships in a given data set and ranks them. MIC, in turn, belongs to a wider family of statistical measures known as maximal information-based nonparametric exploration, or MINE, which can quantify other properties, such as monotonicity and linearity, of the calculated relationships. David Reshef spoke with me about these statistical methods and their applications.
This is a project that I worked on together with my brother Yakir Reshef, who's currently at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, and along with Professors Pardis Sabeti and Michael Mitzemacher of Harvard University. And really the cornerstone of the project is a new measure of dependence, meaning that it's a statistic that can be used to quantify the strength of a relationship between two variables of data. And the statistic, which is called the maximal information coefficient, or MIC, has several sort of desirable properties that make it really powerful for exploring data sets without necessarily having to know what you're searching for ahead of time.
Well, great. Let's step back and talk about the context of this a little bit. So this sort of addresses a major problem or a major issue that, you know, a lot of researchers have, and that's just that we're dealing with simply enormous data sets.
Yeah.
So what are the limitations of our current methods of statistical analysis?
So I think that's easiest to think about in the context of a simple example. I think that the work itself serves to try to answer a very simple question, or at least one that's fairly simple to answer, which is that given these really large data sets which are emerging, you know, if you had one of these large data sets with lots of variables and you knew that there was some sort of structure within that data set, how would you go about finding that structure without necessarily knowing exactly what the structure looked like? Or kind of more generally, how do you find all of the correlations or relationships or associations in that data set? So, you know, there are several different factors that impact how we would want to do this. One is that there are many different types of relationships or patterns in data that look very different. And there are certain statistical tests for finding each of these different types of patterns, but we really want to be able to find all of them. And the second consideration is that, you know, real-world data are inherently noisy, and so we want to be able to have a method that can capture different patterns, even when they're noisy, and be able to do it in a what we call equitable or fair way. So these limitations kind of make it such that it's really hard to apply one statistical test to a data set without knowing ahead of time what you're looking for in that data set and know that you're going to be capturing all of the patterns in that data set, and at the same time to know that you're capturing them all sort of fairly, meaning that, you know, different types of patterns get equal scores if they have the same amount of noise in them, so to speak.
Right. So in a lot of our current statistical methods, you know, what you're saying is that we have to have a hypothesis basically of what the function is that we're looking for and sort of test for a regression on that. So how exactly does this MIC, the maximal information coefficient, sort of address these limitations, but still, you know, include these properties of generality and equitability?
Yeah, that's exactly right. MINE is very much geared towards more of a sort of hypothesis generating approach. And the way that it does this is it's kind of based on this very simple intuition that if you look at just, for example, the scatter plot of a relationship between two different variables, you can kind of grid that scatter plot in a way that assigns, you know, different points to different bins in a grid. And the hypothesis is that if there is a pattern in that data, there is some grid that could capture that pattern reasonably well. And so what MIC is based on very fundamentally is searching for the optimal grid for a given scatter plot of data, and then finding a way to quantify the pattern in that grid and to do so in a way that is able to make it so that you can compare grids of different sizes in a fair way. And so this really gives it that property of generality, meaning that we can find a very broad range of patterns, as well as the property of equitability, meaning that we find them sort of equally well. And what that lets you do in kind of real data sets is, for example, if you have this large data set that we talked about earlier, you could just run MIC on it and get a list of scores back and hopefully be able to trust that the scores that are towards the top are at the top because they're the strongest relationships in your data.
And so you're able to produce all of these results by actually creating matrices of the relationships between all this data and these variables that you're talking about. And what's really interesting about this is that it sort of opens up to a whole family of statistical measures using these matrices. So tell me about those.
So when we kind of search for the optimal grid for a given relationship or a given scatter plot, we try grids of various resolutions. So for example, we'll try gridding the data in a 2x2 grid, and we'll try gridding it in a 3x3 or a 4x3 and so on. And we try to kind of quantify the amount of information that each of these grids captures about our data. And we store that information, like you said, in a matrix. And so eventually we have kind of the most amount of information that a given grid can capture about a given relationship for various grid resolutions. Mm. And when we look across those scores of different grid resolutions, we calculate MIC from that. But at the same time, when you look at that matrix, it turns out that the properties of that matrix actually can tell you about a lot of other properties of your data. And that's what we call this family of other statistics called MINE, or maximal information-based non-parametric exploration statistics. And the idea there is that now not only can you run something like MIC on your data, but you can also start using some of these other properties of the matrix. So for example, one of the other properties of this matrix is that basically we notice that how symmetric it is can tell you about how monotonic your relationship is. So that can be used to find, for example, periodic structure in data. Or there's other statistics that can tell you about the complexity of the relationship you find or to what degree it follows some functional form. And so the idea is that, you know, in these large data sets where you have lots of relationships and now you can quantify the strength of these different relationships, you can also start to classify relationships based on what you might be specifically looking for.
Now, how practical are these statistical methods? I mean, what sort of data sets can these be applied to?
It really can be applied to just about any data set. It's kind of this platform tool, and our goal when developing it was to make it as generally applicable as possible. So, you know, we tried applying it to a broad range of data sets just to demonstrate its utility. So we applied it to all the data from the World Health Organization for all the countries in the world for the last 50 years and analyzed that and downloaded all of, for example, Major League Baseball data from the 2008 season and looked at some yeast gene expression data and looked at some data from the human gut microbiome.
And did you find any novel associations in these data sets?
Yeah, I think that one particularly interesting example is stuff that came out of the human microbiome analysis. And that's particularly an exciting case because this is really an example of a situation where, you know, we have lots of data about the different bacteria that are present, but we don't really know what types of patterns we're necessarily looking for. And we applied it to one of these large gut microbiome data sets provided by Peter Turnbaugh at Harvard University and basically found a set of several hundred different relationships that were really nonlinear and seemed to imply some sort of competitive dynamic or other factors that mediate these relationships. You know, other examples are from things like the Major League Baseball analysis, where we basically looked at some really fundamental questions like what statistics of all the statistics that we collect about players seem to correlate most with player salary or with team wins. And there are some similarities between what we find in some other methods, but there are also some striking differences. So in a realm like baseball where the stakes are so high and everything is so finely measured, it's really interesting to see what can be done with tools like mine.
Well, that's really interesting. So will anyone be able to sort of pick it up and use it in their own data?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, we've tried to make it as practical as possible. So you can go and download the file and you can literally just run it on any one of your data set files and just get back all the scores.
Great. Well, David Reshef, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks so much. It's a pleasure being here.
David and his brother Yakir Reshef are lead authors on a study called Detecting Novel Associations in Large Datasets in this week's Science.
The first tuberculosis vaccine was introduced in the early 20th century, and despite a host of problems, it has been one of the few weapons against the persistent mycobacteria. In the past 10 years, tuberculosis vaccine research has picked up, and researchers are facing a potential new problem: too many vaccine candidates. Kai Kupferschmidt reports on the story in a News Focus article this week. He spoke to me from Berlin about the potential vaccines and their future.
Scientists have been looking for new TB vaccines or for new vaccines to protect against tuberculosis for a couple of years now. And it's starting to pay off in that a few very promising candidates have emerged and they're now entering the proof of principle trials for the first time. So scientists are now looking in human beings whether these vaccines do protect against tuberculosis. And in some ways, the field is at a crossroads because there are so many candidates now for vaccines that the field really has to whittle down and find the most promising ones that they can go into the really big phase three trials that come before any of these could be put on the market, really.
So there are literally billions of people who have gotten the currently available TB vaccine. Why are scientists looking elsewhere?
Well, there are a couple of problems with BCG. So the current vaccine, there's only one vaccine against tuberculosis, and that is called Bacillus Calmette-Guérin, so that's BCG in short. And there are a couple of problems with BCG, I mean, the most important of which is that it just doesn't work very well. So even though it protects children against certain forms of tuberculosis, it doesn't actually protect adults against pulmonary tuberculosis. And that is at the moment the most common form of tuberculosis around. So scientists have always realized that they would need another vaccine really to protect against this form of disease. But there are also other problems. One thing that has emerged only in the last few years is that children who are HIV positive, when they get the BCG vaccine, there's a certain danger that they can't actually control this bacterium, and then they develop a disease called BCGosis, and some of these children actually die. So, well, one of the things that people are looking for really is a vaccine that will protect against tuberculosis without putting these children at risk.
And there's also, I mean, there's also treatment for tuberculosis now, but that's also maybe not working so well anymore.
Right. So the treatment against tuberculosis always is a very long process. It usually takes 4 to 6 months with 2 or 3 or even 4 different drugs. Well, there are a lot of people now who contract multi-drug-resistant TB or even extensively drug-resistant TB, and these are even harder to treat, and sometimes the treatment won't work, so it still isn't possible to be 100% certain that you eradicate all of the bacteria in the body, even with these treatments. So scientists have always hoped for a vaccine that would actually protect against TB, even against the infection, but like I said, BCG, the current vaccine, doesn't really protect against infection. It only protects against the disease and only in certain cases.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of reasons for scientists to go after
right.
a new vaccine. What kind of approaches are they going to use?
At the moment, with the most advanced candidates, there are really two different approaches. So one of them is taking the old vaccine, BCG, and trying to improve it. So scientists take the BCG and they try to either add certain genes that might make it more effective, or they try to delete certain genes. And then there's another approach, which is really the booster approach. So the idea is that children will keep getting vaccinated with BCG, but then maybe a few weeks later or even a few years later, they would get a booster vaccine, so a different vaccine that is supposed to just boost the immune response that they already have. These are really the main two approaches, but then if you look at the vaccines which are at very early stages of development, you have a host of new ideas as well coming up and really trying to improve further on these.
So there's boosters, and then there's also starting a clean slate,
yeah,
a new different kind of infant vaccine.
Yeah, replacements really for BCG, yeah.
You also talked about how, you know, there's a lot of impetus to start developing a new vaccine because it's not working or because disease treatment has been really difficult. Is there also funding or other organizations that are driving this interest?
Yeah, so funding for the TB field has really increased in the last few years, I think. One of the milestones probably was in 1993 when the World Health Organization, the WHO, declared TB a global emergency. That was probably when a lot of people kind of picked up and started putting more money into the field. And then when the drug-resistant tuberculosis started to spread, that was another thing where also Western governments started to put a lot of money into it. So at the moment, there is quite a lot of money being spent on TB research by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, or by Western governments. But at the same time, the scientists in the field are saying that it's not close to enough money to really get this thing done. There are a couple of nonprofit organizations, for example, in the U.S., there's ERAS, mm-hmm. which is a nonprofit product development partnership that really has the goal of developing a TB vaccine. And then similarly in Europe, there's a foundation called the TB Vaccine Initiative, which is also trying to get candidates into clinical trials.
So there's enough money for now, but maybe not to see them all the way through to scaling up. Is there a coordinated effort among these different entities to see only the best candidates make it through to that last phase?
Yeah, I think the field at the moment is really looking hard at that question, trying to find out how many vaccines can we really put through clinical trials and what are the best ones that we should allow to develop further. So, for example, TBVI and ERAS are trying to develop something like a blueprint for a gating process, really, that decides at every stage of development, you know, what are the best candidates that we have? What are the candidates that should be allowed to go through to the next stage of development? Because the point in vaccine trials, even more than in normal drug trials, is the first stages of development are very cheap compared to the last stages. So really, now that the first candidates are reaching phase three clinical trials, it's going to be so much money that's needed that it's very clear that you can only do that for a couple of candidates. So just to put that in numbers maybe for a second, a phase one vaccine trial would cost maybe $1 to $5 million, but a phase three trial would cost up to $200 million. And that's the kind of money that people are looking at now. And if you look at the funding situation for the field at the moment, people estimate that there's about $500 million for TB research every year available, and only about a quarter of that is available for vaccines. So it's clear that there's not enough money to put, even at the moment, to put even one of these through a clinical trial.
Finally, I want to go a little into the future. We may be getting a vaccine that prevents TB. And what's out there now to tackle the dormant bacteria that is present in so many people around the world? Are there any possibilities?
Well, scientists are really looking at different approaches now. One of them, if we get a vaccine, the first vaccine that would be on the market would probably be something that also prevents disease better than BCG, but there's still, you know, nothing that prevents the infection, nothing that gets rid of the dormant bacteria. And one of the approaches that scientists are looking at is really identifying certain genes that are expressed in tuberculosis bacteria when they are dormant. So genes that are upregulated in dormant bacteria, and then to take these kinds of antigens and put them into a vaccine that would specifically try to eradicate TB in patients who haven't developed the disease yet, but who have the bacteria in them. And if you have the bacteria in you, there's a lifetime chance of about 1 in 10 that you will at some point develop TB disease. So, and since there are about 2 billion people, actually more than 2 billion people in the world who are infected with TB, this is obviously a huge need that needs to be addressed. And then in the long run, once these kinds of stages have actually been met, there's also the idea that maybe it is now time that scientists can really look for a vaccine that would prevent infection. So it would prevent that bacteria would ever even get into the body and get into a dormant state.
Just to clarify, so the vaccines that you talked about a little earlier that have already been through some safety trials, are any of them targeted at preventing infection?
Well, I think all of them are going to be looking at preventing infection. So really, when you do a clinical trial, you look for how many people get TB in the group that gets this vaccine as compared to the group that only got BCG. But then you would also be able to pick up a signal which would show that they didn't even get infected with TB. But at the moment, scientists don't think it's very likely that these vaccines will actually be enough to prevent infection. It just hasn't been done yet, and you would probably need to specifically look for mechanisms that would prevent infection. Scientists would be elated if it turned out that one of these candidates actually prevents infection, but they weren't specifically designed to do that. They were designed to prevent disease.
Ah, interesting. Kai Kuverschmidt, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Sarah.
Kai Kupferschmidt is the author of a News Focus article on the state of tuberculosis vaccine research.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So first, we're talking about a curious vocal pattern that is creeping its way into mainstream speech.
Right, Carrie, this pattern is called vocal fry, and it's very popular now among female pop stars, but you hear it all the time, even on the radio. For some reason in the U.S., this is a vocal pattern more common among women than men, and if I can approximate it, it sounds a little bit something like this. You know, it's sort of like crackling of your voice that can happen at the end of sentences. It doesn't even necessarily have to be at the end of sentences. And I think I actually just did it again. Very much conscious of vocal fry since I read this story. But anyway, the question in this study was, is this a budding trend in American English? Is this something that is becoming more common? And that's what the researchers sent out to find out.
And I think it's interesting to note that all the descriptions of this phenomenon are all really sensorially rich. You know, it's vocal fry. It's
yes.
creaky. It's
exactly,
fluttering and staccato.
Exactly.
But this is not something that's really, I think, new in speech. So why is this study coming out now?
It's a good question. Actually, scientists have known about vocal fry for a long time, and it used to be thought of as a speech disorder. In fact, it was even thought that it could harm the vocal cords. So it was sort of seen as a bad thing. But in this new study, the scientists didn't really think this was a disorder. They said, you know, we're hearing this so often that this must be becoming a normal part of speech. And they really wanted to figure out how frequent it was. And what they did was they took 34 female speakers, because like I said, you know, in the U.S. at least, it seems to be more common among women than men, this vocal fry. And they actually basically just had them talk to some speech therapists, and they had their voices recorded, and the observers tracked vocal fry. And what they found was that more than two-thirds of the research subjects that they looked at used vocal fry in their speech. So it was very common in this sort of randomly selected group of people. So what the researchers say is, first of all, that shows it's very prevalent. And also, they said that based on the speech patterns that they heard, this probably isn't harmful to the vocal cords because the speakers aren't creaking continuously or at the end of every sentence. It's not a constant thing. It's kind of like an affect or an accent that's sort of thrown in here or there, but they don't think it's happening frequently enough in speech to cause any problems.
All right. And next up, we have a thermal illusion.
Right. So from a sort of speech, quote unquote, disorder to something that's sort of more a trick of the mind than a trick of speech. This is something known as the thermal grill illusion. And you can actually try this for yourself at home if you want to. You can take some hot dogs out of the refrigerator and warm some of them up. Don't make them hot, but just sort of warm some of them up and keep the other ones cold. And then maybe put 5 hot dogs on the counter in a warm, cold pattern, and then put your hand on it. And what you'll find, surprisingly, is that even though these hot dogs aren't hot, your hand will actually burn, almost the same sensation that you might get if you touched very cold snow. And this illusion has been known to scientists for more than 100 years, but they don't know why it causes pain.
So in a sense, it's almost the overall effect is not the sum of its parts, that the cold and the heat, neither of them is painful on their own.
Neither of them is painful on their own, but somehow when you put them together and you put them together in this pattern, it causes pain. And so what the researchers tried to do is they tried to figure out what was going on here. And they took a bunch of volunteers and they put them in an fMRI scanner. And fMRI scanners measure different parts of the brain and they look for brain activity in different parts of the brain. And what the researchers found, they actually didn't use hot dogs here because that wouldn't really work inside an fMRI scanner. What they did was they took these little plastic boxes that had these silver bars on them, and they pumped warm or cold water through the bars in this alternating pattern. And then they had subjects basically touch this box while they were in the fMRI scanner. And as expected, when the researchers created this alternating warm and cold pattern, the subject said, hey, that's kind of painful. The illusion was working. And in their minds, what was happening was that their thalamus, which is this region of the brain which is really important for processing sensory impulses, really showed itself to be very active. And also part of the brain's pain matrix, which is this collection of regions that manage pain, also became active. So the subjects weren't just sort of saying that they felt pain. Their brains were actually telling them that, hey, you're feeling pain.
So this all seems related to the study of pain and neuroscience in general. How does this influence that whole realm of study?
So I guess the issue here is, you know, what the researchers are trying to figure out is, does this sort of illusory pain tell us anything about real pain. And curiously, there's a condition known as cold allodynia. And this often happens to people that get a stroke. Something that just feels cool to the rest of us feels very painful to people with this condition. And researchers have also been studying this condition to figure out what is it in the brain that actually causes us to feel pain. And what this team wants to do is see whether these people that experience cold allodynia are having activation in the same part of the brain that the people that are experiencing this thermal grill illusion. And if so, it could really shed a lot of light about how our brains process pain, and it could even lead to treatments for people that have these disorders to potentially lessen the amount of pain that they feel.
Okay, and finally, we have some interesting insight into the relationship between humans and snakes.
Right. This last study concerns a tribe of people known as the Agta Negritos that live in the Philippines, or at least they used to. They're pretty much dying out, unfortunately. And this tribe has been around for a long time and has had a lot of nasty encounters with snakes. There's a lot of very big snakes that live in this area. Some of these snakes are pythons that are 5 meters long, and they're just kilograms, kilograms of weight. And you can actually see a picture of one of these snakes on the site. And these snakes, as you would expect, are not very friendly neighbors. In fact, the Agta Negritos report in this study, they were interviewed for this research, that every 2 to 3 years, a member of the tribe was either seriously injured or actually killed by one of these snakes. And that's not surprising. You know, people get hurt by snakes all the time.
Well, we all know that snakes are a nuisance and can be dangerous to humans. So what led to us taking a closer look at how much they actually interact with us?
Right, right. It's pretty obvious that snakes hurt us. What this new study was asking is it more than just a one-way street? In other words, are we also hurting snakes? And if we're doing that, if we're hurting snakes and snakes are hurting us, are we actually influencing each other's evolutionary history, which would be really interesting. And what the researchers found was, you know, they interviewed a lot of members of this tribe, and they discovered, you know, as I said, that a lot of people in this tribe have been hurt by snakes in the past. But what they also discovered is that the members of the tribe actually also have been hunting these snakes for a long time. These snakes can be very big. They're obviously good sources of meat, and this is sort of a hunter-gatherer culture, so they're going out in the forest and they're actually hunting. And the third interesting thing about this relationship is that not only are the snakes hurting people and the people are hurting snakes, but they're also competing with each other for the same food. A lot of times when the hunters would kill these snakes, they would find that inside the snakes there were wild deer, believe it or not, wild pig, and monkeys. That just gives you a sense of how big these snakes are. And these were the same animals that the humans themselves were hunting. So there's a really complex relationship going on here between snakes and people.
So from this, what are scientists extrapolating as our sort of history going back with these snakes?
Well, they're saying that if what's true for the Agta Negritos is true for human beings going far back in history, and they think it might be because they looked at some other primates and they found a similar relationship with snakes, then it means that there's this sort of evolutionary arms race going on between people and snakes. So the idea would be, you know, if snakes are hurting people, people have to develop maybe very good eyesight to see the snakes, especially if the snakes are a thick brush or whatever. And so that maybe our vision got better because of snakes. And on the flip side, snakes are trying to avoid being killed by people. So maybe they developed better camouflage so we couldn't hunt them. I mean, this is all very speculative. But now that scientists know that this complex relationship exists, they can really look at the evolutionary history of both us and of snakes and figure out just how much influence we've had on each other.
Well, I'm glad we don't have pythons running loose in downtown D.C.
That's true.
All right. Well, what else have we had on the news site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got stories on the physics of rainbows, or the physics of double rainbows, actually, and also about why hairy people are more likely to detect parasites on their skin. Kind of gross, but interesting science there. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about funding for malaria research and what impact it's having on malaria deaths worldwide. Also, a study about brain scans in the courtroom. Is it kosher to scan the brains of defendants to see whether they are telling the truth, whether they are mentally insane, and a bunch of other things? And finally, this week on Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, we'll be covering the announcement by CERN this week of the possible discovery of the Higgs boson. We'll have a couple big scientists on there to talk about what it all means for the Higgs, for science, and for physics going forward. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
I will definitely check those out. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the December 16th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.